I've seen my role really as cultural translator, as being a bridge between worlds, a bridge between ways of knowing, helping people to come back home to their bodies and to their communities, to their environments, and having time to reconnect to those things and people and places that make us whole. This is a medical system that's incredibly complex, and yet it's really simple. It's about just these processes that we all know, but I think in our world, we've gotten disconnected from those, and just bringing that synergy back together and giving people permission to do that has been a big part of the journey.
Welcome to Mind and Life. I'm Wendy Hasenkamp. My guest today is biocultural anthropologist Tawny Tidwell. Tawny is a scientist at the Center for Healthy Minds at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and she's also a Tibetan medical doctor. Her interests lie at the intersection of minds, bodies, and cultures, and she's been studying ways of both living and dying with greater awareness and well-being. Along those lines, she's been leading a fascinating project through the Center for Healthy Minds, where she's studying a phenomenon in the Tibetan community known as tukdum. Tawny explains a lot more about this in the episode, but I'll just say briefly here that this is when advanced meditators are reportedly able to extend the process of dying much, much longer than we normally think is possible in the West. This raises all kinds of deep questions around the nature of consciousness, the nature of life, the limits of science, subtle energy or subtle body, and perhaps points to some of the far edges of what might be possible through contemplative practice. We get into all of this in today's conversation, and a lot more too. We talk about different cultural approaches to body and health, understanding individual differences around which kinds of practices and medicine might be best for someone, and the effectiveness of Tibetan medicine in treating COVID. Tawny and I were actually scheduled to have this conversation in the spring of 2020, but then COVID and many other things happened, so I'm glad we were finally able to connect, and I'm really happy to be able to share her amazing work and incredibly holistic perspective with you. You can check the show notes for more on her research, and there's also a link to a recent documentary about the tukdum project if you want to dive deeper into that. All right, I really think you'll enjoy this one. I'm so happy to share with you Tawny Tidwell. It is such a pleasure to welcome Tawny Tidwell to the show. Tawny, it's great to see you. Thanks a lot for being here.
Thanks so much, Wendy. It's such a pleasure to be here. Really an honor.
I'd love to start with some background from the guests. So I would love to hear how you got interested in biocultural anthropology, and maybe you could even share what exactly that is for listeners, and your path into Tibetan medicine and all of the amazing things that you do.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I think best way to start with that is I was really interested in being an aerospace medical doctor. I was interested in extreme conditions of the body, weightlessness, high altitude growing up in Colorado. My family has Native American heritage. I don't look like it, but on my both my paternal grandfather's side, Cherokee, and then on my maternal grandmother's side, on Oglala Lakota, and my grandpa, my mom's grandpa, grew up on the Assiniboine Reservation, Wolf Point, Montana. And so I think for me, always trying to understand how we understand our bodies, the landscapes, health, wellness, and how we read that on the land. And I think knowing that we had lived in off the land in ways that are so different than the way that we live today. And I think I always have been interested in that. My paternal grandfather, we would be, you know, hunting for arrowheads growing up, and he would talk about, you know, riding horses and the settlers coming in. I mean, these were not actually true stories, but like some mythology for my young mind to just like imagine this other way of living. And I think that that really struck a chord with me also because we lived in Korea when I was really young, from age 2 to 5. My dad was in the military there. And I think coming back to the U.S. and people asking me, you know, where are you from? And I was like, Korea.
Yeah. You know?
And then look at me like this confused young little girl. And I think seeing through a different culture's eyes about how we know what we know, and that our cultures inform that. And so I think that when I was an undergrad at Stanford pre-med, wanting to do medicine, I always assumed that I also wanted to study for a while, say in China, some Chinese medicine as well, and to look at how we can question our understandings of how the body functions and mm-hmm. stress and different ways. And so as I was going through, you know, freshman year, sophomore year, I started learning about the Tibetan community in India. I had met the Dalai Lama in high school, and there was a program in Dharamsala, and I just decided to go.
Mm-hmm.
This was Emory's first batch, the first Tibetan studies program.
Wow.
And so Stanford let you just kind of not register for the next quarter. So I, quote, stopped out and joined this program. And in that semester program, we could also have research. And so I wanted to understand what this medical system was, Tibetan medicine. And so started learning about, you know, this amazing culture on the rooftop of the world and how this medical system probably has something to tell us about the body, about how we've lived in totally extreme environments and yogis doing crazy things with their bodies, right? Manipulating their, you know, metabolism and, you know, being able to go into freezing conditions and bring up heat. And so something struck really closely with me in that I went back. I was a physics major in pre-med, and I just kind of thought, wow, you know, this is something that I really want to understand more and understand more of my own heritage. And I think that was what led me then to continue going back to Tibet. I went 3 times again as an undergrad, and it was like commuting to Asia. And at the very end of Stanford, decided that physics was not what I wanted to study. I wanted to study ecology. I wanted to study our systems and our health, how we understand our body's health through the environment, because that felt like so much of what I was understanding from the Tibetan medical perspective, but also from a lot of our native heritage. And graduated, went and lived in the woods, and did a lot of wilderness survival with some wilderness and nature awareness schools, learning, you know, these skills. And that was a time when my grandpa was passing. So there was also a way that it was reconnecting with him. He had gone back to the reservation and learning these skills that he was really close to, but our greater family didn't really understand, didn't really appreciate. And in that experience, realized that what I wanted to do was to help people learn about their relationship to their bodies, to the earth, and to community, and what did that look like?
Mm-hmm.
And so in my mind, the medicine part of that looked like studying Tibetan medicine. But I wanted the science. I was such a nerd, you know, I loved the science. And so I thought, well, I want to pursue training in graduate work that allows me to understand these aspects of culture, of biology, of how culture gets under the skin, how our minds change our bodies, how our ways of living, ways of knowing literally change the way we experience well-being. And so I started applying to all these different PhD programs. I thought, oh, interdisciplinary in science. And little did I know that doesn't actually exist, right? So I was in India. I was studying with my teacher, Amchi Kenob Gyamso, who was the vice principal of Mensikon College, and just starting to learn a little bit about Tibetan medicine, thinking about maybe eventually taking the entrance exam. I was working with the Tibetan Studies program at Emory. So I was at that time a teaching fellow with Geshe Ma Kelsang Wangmo. And lo and behold, there was Professor Carol Worthman in our kitchen. And she said, why didn't you apply to anthropology? It's like, no, I'm not interested in, like, you know, humanities, cultural way. Like, I'm interested in biology. And she, you know, she's this phenomenal neuroendocrinologist doing, you know, groundbreaking work. She's like, I think you don't understand what anthropology really could be. And so she started telling me about biocultural anthropology and the strengths of understanding the cultural intersections with the biological intersections, and how we can really see that ways of living, different populations, different cultures, our relationships with environments, our communities, our intellectual history shape the way that we experience life and well-being. And I was hooked. So that was it. And so I applied to their program, and so I was kind of doing an MD, PhD, Tibetan style through Emory. So that's how I came to it.
Amazing. I love how this frame just like weaves together so many perspectives into one lens. So I'm really excited to talk to you about your work. I thought maybe it might be helpful for the audience just to go through a little bit of the perspective of Tibetan medicine on, you know, minds and bodies, and like you said, the perspectives of well-being and health, because some of them are quite different from what people in Western systems might be familiar with. So I don't know if there's a simple way to introduce that, but I would love to hear more about that.
Yeah, so Tibetan medicine is one of the four great Asian scholastic medical systems, with Ayurveda, Chinese medicine, and Unani. And so it was co-developed similar to Ayurveda in India in the great Buddhist monastic institutions. And this is when the Shravakas, a lot of these yogis that were in especially Eastern India, were looking at aspects of the body. This is when the Vedic system was really dominant as well. And they were kind of pushing against these purification rites of the Vedic period. And we're really interested in different empirical ways to understand the body, how Buddhism helped us to understand the role of the mind and the body. And so a lot of that early work and a lot of the treatises that were developed and what we see in the Buddhist canon as well informed what became Ayurveda, and then also then came into Tibet. And then as it came into Tibet in the 7th, 8th century, you had, I mean, this was just medicine, right? It wasn't like these different traditions coming from different areas. So you had medicine coming in from Persia, from Greece, from China, from all over, texts being translated. And that's what became Tibetan medicine, is understanding the phenomenal breadth of the different kinds of medicines, from plant medicine to mineral medicines, the geologics, the soil, different fauna, bringing that all into this huge pharmacopoeia, to different techniques, from cupping to needling to massage therapy, medicinal bath, looking at lifestyle and diet, different environments, and how our different individual constitutions require different diets, different kinds of lifestyles. And so what Tibetan medicine has become is this comprehensive system where diet, lifestyle, medicine, and these external therapies are the way that we approach health. And then our relationship to community, social relationships, and environment. So in a really simple context, when someone comes in, a lot of it's understanding, say, if they have cancer, what are the conditions that they've been experiencing over the years, right, that might have led to that kind of condition? Are there certain kind of stresses and inflammations in the body? Or is it more of their lineage, right, that's been giving them a more vulnerability to that certain condition? Or exposures, right, toxic exposures, and looking in that whole picture, and then bringing in therapies that bring in diet, lifestyle, medicine, and maybe some external therapies to help their healing journey. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's, I love how holistic that perspective is, looking at all those different influences. You mentioned a little bit about constitutions and the different constitutions that people have. I wonder if you could expand on that just a little bit, because I feel like that's a piece that doesn't really exist in Western medicine, that, you know, many of these, as you said, the kind of great traditional systems really rely on. Mm-hmm. Could you share a little bit about constitutions?
Yeah, I think actually what's so exciting to me is that so much that has developed in our Western science is moving towards that personalized medicine model. Mm-hmm. And it's actually moving towards understanding what Tibetan medicine describes as constitution. So it's looking at that developmental context when we're in the womb, and how we get imprinted with certain kinds of proclivities, that we have certain kinds of genetic, so genotypic and phenotypic, the way that our bodies are programmed to express themselves physically, but also emotionally, the kind of patterns that we have. And that first 1,000 days also, even after birth, our environments, the social relationships, our families kind of imprint us and mm-hmm. set up these kind of initial conditions that then have massive implications into the way that our health is expressed throughout our life course, and the way that we respond to stresses, the way that we respond to different social interactions. And so from the Tibet medical perspective, that has physical vulnerabilities, but also different kind of emotional patterns that we express. And so some people might have more have a tendency to be more irritable than others, mm-hmm. or, you know, more content and satisfied with their lives, or might have just a lot of yearning that constantly drives certain kinds of behaviors, a lot of seeking behaviors. And so those are all what Tibet medicine understands as this constitution, that then means that they need certain kinds of foods, certain kinds of social relationships. Some people need more social interaction, some people need less. And so all of those come into how a Tibetan physician then advises what's appropriate for that individual as well.
Yeah. There's another piece that I'd love to hear your perspective on, which is related to consciousness and sometimes described as a subtle body or the subtle mind, which is, I think, a very different concept from Western systems. So maybe you could frame that a little bit, and then I'm sure we'll talk a lot more about that in some of the projects that you've been getting into.
Yeah, absolutely. So the way Tibetan medicine, and this intersects with the Buddhist perspective on the mind, looks at the subtle body is that we have our physical substrate, which has both kind of subtle and coarse aspects of it. So I like to give the analogy that, the coarse body, which is our cells and tissues and all the different pathways in the body set up for kind of our mass or coarse physical function. And the subtle is like the neuroendocrine system. It's like the subtle interconnections across all the different physical systems of the body that our stress response, our inclinations, all these things. Some of our more subtle aspects of mind come from that subtle body. And so Lung is the winds in the body from the Tibetan medical system. They also have coarse functions from swallowing and, you know, walking and moving. But then the subtle parts is really the functions of the mind. It animates everything. It's everything that gets signaled in the body. And so those subtle signals is the subtle body, and the mind is considered intimately connected to that subtle system, such that coarse mental functions, which are, you know, our thoughts and our emotional reactions, when on a subtle level, it's just these slight impulses, right? So tendencies, ways of seeing and viewing the world that actually have phenomenally gross manifestations, but that actually derive from this really subtle orientation and subtle patterning of the body. And so that would be that subtle body.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. You mentioned how, you think about the subtle body as these more nuanced, complex interactions like neuroendocrine and things like that. Is there also another level that's like I've heard it described like a purely energy body?
Yeah.
That we don't really have that construct in Western medicine? Or do you view it actually as there are these parallels to physical systems that we understand in Western medicine?
Yeah, it's such a great question. I mean, this is getting into the massive research project that we have at the center. So I think that's the question is, what are the instruments that we have and what are the assumptions that we have on the Western side about the mind? And I think that's what we've really come to grapple with is that we don't really have a good understanding of what is the mind or what is consciousness from the Western perspective. And so what are we looking for? And so I think that this question of from the Tibetan Buddhist or Tibetan medical perspective, like what comes from one lifetime to another, like what is that subtle mind, right? From the Western perspective, we don't recognize that necessarily, especially in the science world. And so what is that body? We would say that is pure energy. There's a aspect of lucidity, aspect of clarity that also has the capacity to have imprints from our life and to affect other aspects of our new manifestations. And so we could see that as a pure energy that we wouldn't necessarily understand from the Western perspective, for sure. Yeah.
Right. And that's linking into, maybe it's also worth just explaining a little bit about the perspective of multiple lives, like a consciousness continuing through multiple different lives.
Absolutely. And that our current lifetime might synergize some of those imprints, or some of those might remain dormant and then emerge later in future lives too. And so we're kind of experiencing the cumulative effect of countless lifetimes and might not know where those impulses are coming from. You know, two kids that grow up in the same home can be so dramatically different, right? And so from the Tibetan medical perspective, it's like, yeah, there's a lot of lifetimes imprinting those experiences and ways of being.
Right. Yeah. So the idea in that system, in the Tibetan system, is that there's some level of consciousness that continues through multiple lifetimes as kind of the same, there are the same imprints or patterns that get translated. I mean, sometimes this is called reincarnation, or there's so many different terms for it. I don't know the best way to describe it, but there's something the same that is transmitted over many, many lifetimes. Is that you can probably explain that better, but just to kind of lay that groundwork.
No, yeah. So it's described as it's called the Alaya Vijnana, which is the storehouse consciousness. So it's these seeds, it's these very, very subtle seeds that are what is transmitted from one lifetime to the other. So those seeds get planted in each lifetime that we experience. And some of them can ripen at different times and come to full fruition. Others might actually be cleared or cleansed, so to speak. And so we experience that kind of flux in this like very, very foundational consciousness. And so our experience in this lifetime is kind of acting on all those seeds from all the previous lifetimes. And then we'll also embed new seeds in the next lifetime. Or if we're really remarkable practitioners, might actually bring to fruition a realized state where those karmic seeds are purified.
Right, right. So then the cycle stops, is that?
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to get to the Thukdam project that you've been working on. But first, I just want to ask one side question, thinking about these kind of multiple lifetimes. And I'm wondering what you think about current work around epigenetics and kind of thinking about intergenerational transmission of things like trauma or experiences that we're learning about from the biological perspective. I always feel like that has really interesting implications when you think of these Buddhist perspectives on multiple lives.
Absolutely. I think this is where I was also alluding to in the constitution conversation that we were just having about how, you know, aspects of the microbiome and psychoneuroimmunology and then epigenetics help us to understand that we all have these kind of individual signatures of our mind and body, but also these signatures come from previous lifetimes that we inherit, right?
Yeah.
The epigenetic aspect. And so I think it's such a remarkable way that we are understanding that from the Western science perspective, of that we could be experiencing things from our grandparents, our great-grandparents that can be trauma, can be ways of stress response, can be, I mean, the Dutch famine study also, like just the way our metabolism works can come from experience of our grandparents, right? It's like,
right,
that's remarkable. And that we have the opportunity to change that too, right? We can heal those. We can actually change the way that we then transmit that to our offspring and to our next generations.
Right, which opens up the idea of intergenerational transmissions of positive frames, possibly.
Yeah.
Too, right?
Yeah, bringing healing, bringing different ways of being. I mean, I think in our day and age when we're seeing so much angst, right, and how we can set up as a global community a different way of being for our next generation. I think sometimes people feel really distraught at this time, but it's also important, I think, for us to realize we have so much power in what things look like generations from now.
Well, let's jump into this study that you are currently leading. So I will let you describe the whole framework. It's called the Thukdam Project. And so maybe we could start with what is the phenomenon or experience of Thukdam and how you go about studying that.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you. So this started in 1995. It was a conversation with His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, and Richie Davidson in a Mind and Life Dialogues. And it was His Holiness talking about his tutor, Ling Rinpoche, and that his tutor had gone into this state of Thukdam, which is when the heart and lungs stop functioning, presumably also the brain no longer has gross activities, and is clinically dead, basically, from the Western perspective, and yet shows no signs of decomposition. The skin remains elastic. Often these individuals are in a full meditative posture, sometimes full lotus posture. They look radiant. Oftentimes they might be quite ill before they pass, and somehow the appearance is more radiant than just before clinical death. And they can last in this state for, and this was Ling Rinpoche's, 13 days.
Wow.
And so our longest case so far has been 38 days. So it can last a long time before any sign of decomposition, any sign of smell starts happening. And so His Holiness turned to Richie and said, I think you should study this.
Yes.
And I think you should bring the best of the best of science to do so. I think it will question fundamental understandings of consciousness and the mind. This hard philosophical question of, is consciousness an epiphenomena of the brain, or is there different ways to understand the mind and the way that we can think about living and the transition from living to dying? And so from that time, it took a while to get equipment into the field. So Tukdom is a state that is considered like the Olympics of enlightenment, right? It's the time when the coarse body functions cease, and it provides this remarkable opportunity to witness the nature of mind that we all have. We all have this opportunity when we die, but those who train lifetimes, and particularly all their life, to be present for this moment, have the opportunity to really see that clear light mind in that moment. And in that recognition, sustain that to reside in that state. And that is a state of realization. And so from the Tibetan Buddhist perspective, that clear light consciousness really resides at the heart. And so there's not an expectation that there would be many brain signals at that point, even at the brainstem level, and that we should be looking at really some residual activity at maybe a cellular level at the heart. And so the idea is, how do we measure that?
Yes.
And so the team here in Wisconsin, this was the Weizmann Brain Imaging Center at the time, started to pull together money from donors from all different places to get EEG equipment, EKG, blood oximetry, full psychophys equipment into the field, including thermography, so infrared cameras, to be able to be ready anytime a case occurs to go to that case. And so because this is such a sensitive state, and that historically, traditionally, no one would be allowed around that practitioner, that the room would be closed, not even a butter lamp would be lit, not even incense, except for the closest attendants, perhaps. And so the fact that His Holiness really encouraged the community to be open to scientists coming and studying it was huge. And not everyone was open to it, but many started to become open to it. And so when a case would occur, so we had two kits, one in North India and one in South India, that were installed. And when a case occurred, the team would go. And this was a collaboration with Mensikang, the Tibet Medical Institute in India. And our Amchis, our Tibetan physicians, would drop their caseload, or some of them were in the research department, and would go to a case to start recording.
How often does this phenomenon happen?
So this is something we don't quite know yet.
Yeah.
Since the beginning of the project, it was maybe like 2 to 3 per year.
Okay.
But as more and more openness has occurred, for example, in 2020, 2021, we had like 10 cases, 11 cases, 12 cases, and many that we knew about but were not open to being investigated. And as, you know, Dikila Chungyelpa has talked about her family in Sikkim, and especially a lot of these remarkable practitioners in that area, Karma Kagyu and Nyingma, it's so common, right? So they're like, yeah, this happens all the time.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
And so we don't know. And also for different traditions, they don't remain in the state for as long. So it might be just 3 days and then the state is released. And that's because the recognition of the nature of mind has occurred, right? And it has occurred maybe many times throughout their lifetime. And the interest is not to sustain that state. But especially in the Gelug school of Tibetan Buddhism, there's more emphasis on shamatha, of the stability of the calm abiding of the mind, and these really, really elaborate visualizations of the mandala, of many, many deities in the mandala. And so as the visualization is dissolving in the mind of the practitioner, that can take a long time. And so they will remain in that state of recognition for a long time. And in fact, even in the Gelug school, they would say that sometimes it's too long, that there is a request made through prayers, through different recitations, to bring the practitioner out to say, please release that state, because the idea is that maybe in their next life, they might not have as sharp of faculties, right? That they kind of bliss out, so to speak.
Interesting. So From this perspective, just within the Tibetan system, death is viewed obviously as much more of a process, like a longer process than I think we view it in the West. So that might be interesting to kind of just talk about those differences. But when in a situation of tukdam or any time, at what point do they consider death to finally have occurred? Like, what are the markers?
Yeah, great. Yeah. So when the state is released by the practitioner, then it's said that you have red and white fluids coming out of the nose and the reproductive organs.
What are those fluids?
Yeah, we don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is something that we've been trying to study also as a team to collect those fluids. It doesn't always happen. So that's another aspect of it. But from the forensic perspective, they would say that it's purge fluid, but it's quite different. It's quite red and quite white or clearish. So we haven't had the opportunity to investigate that yet, although it's been collected by attendants. And usually because those substances are really precious, considered the embodiment of bodhicitta or the enlightened mind, then it's not necessarily, don't just give it to a scientist to study.
Right.
So the other sign is that you see a marked drooping of the body. So before it was quite erect, putrefaction. So the putrid odor, this decompositional smell comes in very strongly. Usually when the state is present, people describe the odor as floral, very almost rose-like. And so this transition in the odor is really strong. And then literally a skin slippage, the venal network starting to be apparent, the blue vein network starting to become more and more apparent. So you have the putrefaction of the tissues, the decomposition of the body. And so this has been really interesting because in the history of the study, we've been focusing on the neuroscience, right?
Mm-hmm.
But often we don't get to the body till 3 days in. Often it's not even notified till 3 days in.
Okay.
So one wouldn't expect brain activity to be occurring at that point. So we published this null finding paper to say, lo and behold, there's no brain activity.
Yeah.
So we've switched to forensics. Like, what can we see about the body? And what's really cool about that is that Buddhist, you know, epistemology or ways of knowing really understands that there's specific signs. And so we can create this map from the Western side and the Buddhist side to say, what does that look like? And so the whole study has now completely changed to really about forensics and the oral microbiome, trying to collect a little bit of saliva or a little bit of skin to see what are the bacterial transitions of that, to collect the volatile organic compounds, the odors. And so in 2020, His Holiness requested that our team work with the Russian Academy of Sciences, who are also really interested in it. So they recruited a lot of our Emory Tibet Science Initiative monastics who had been trained at Emory in science, like, fantastically, right, had gone back to their monasteries to lead science centers, and brought them to Russia to learn neuroimaging, you know, brought them back to their monasteries. And now we have a team of over 65 field team members.
Wow.
In all the different monasteries, both north and south, primarily Gelug still right now. And they are our field team. And a lot of our Tibetan physicians said, you know, it's been a lot to leave behind our clinical duties and actually to have the monastic team right in the monasteries ready to be present at a case is ideal. And it's their elders, right? It's their...
Oh, it often happens in the monasteries.
In the monasteries, sometimes in the community as well. So
Yeah. It's
completely changed the entire project to look at, how do we understand the body? Will this tell us anything about consciousness? I don't know. But it will tell us that there's something different happening that even forensics really doesn't understand. This is an area of forensics that they're kind of just blown away by. They've never studied in this way,
right?
These long states.
I was going to ask, in modern Western forensics perspective, all of those things that you mentioned about, you know, the putrefaction of the body and the degradation, that seems like the normal progression, what we would expect after death, but it just would happen much faster.
48 hours.
Okay, yeah, I was going to ask, what's the normal trajectory that we would consider?
2 days, yeah. So now we have over 47 cases that we studied as a team, and so we've submitted for publication, and a lot of their questions is, what about the controls? How do kind of the normal death transitions look like in that community, environmental? And so we've been documenting, you know, temperature and humidity. These are tropical regions where people go very fast. They decompose very fast. And also showing that the way that we understand kind of the bacterial environment is that it's such a rich bacterial environment, especially in these areas, right? And you would expect the activity to be much faster. These are often lung conditions that are passing. There's a high rate of tuberculosis in the community. So lung conditions, liver conditions, gut conditions. And so then the bacteria are even more active.
Right.
And Tibetans often at this state are not taking antibiotics that slow the decompositional processes down. But these are all data that we have to be collecting and demonstrating, because this is the question. I mean, for no decomposition to occur for 38 days, that's the question. Well, what were they taking, right? Or maybe they were fasting for the last 6 months, right? And so, of course, their metabolism slowed down. And that's not the case. Yeah.
This is so fascinating. So the idea, just from a simplistic perspective, is that these advanced practitioners or people who can enter this state are holding on to some subtle level of consciousness that is keeping their physical body from decaying on the normal trajectory. And is it assumed that they are in a conscious state? I guess we don't know, but do they still assume to have their consciousness like they had when they were alive?
Yeah, so in many ways, their consciousness or their mind is considered greatly expanded. Mm-hmm. So their sensory consciousness are considered to have dissipated. So like hearing, for example, but there is recitations requesting them to come out of the state. And so the idea is that their mind consciousness is hearing, quote, those recitations and responding to them. And so many describe that these great practitioners, you can feel their presence massively across the landscape or in the region. I mean, so something that we don't obviously investigate, but is really important to the tradition is what happens in the weather, right? That you have clearing of skies, you have rainbows, you have these beautiful events happen, and that's this lucidity of the consciousness changing the environment, right? And so these are, all questions of, well, then, but what's happening in the body at that time? And I think that's what's interesting from the microbiome perspective is that I didn't realize that forensics actually doesn't have a good understanding of how to estimate time since death. That as a discipline, it really developed out of criminality, right? Like who did what and, for the courtroom. But things like, sainthood in the Catholic tradition or Salakana in the Jain tradition, where you see also really interesting changes in the dying state or how people live their lives and how that changes what they look in the dying state. They haven't really looked at that. So there's now places in the U.S. and Canada called body farms in Tennessee, Texas, and Alabama, and then up in Montreal, where they just put bodies in all different situations that have been donated to science and investigate that. And it's really the microbiome that they've realized is the key to understanding time since death. So for us in the Tukdum study, then, we have a really wonderful opportunity to say, if there's a subtle activity happening, maybe the bacteria also are getting signals that it's not time to start decomposing the body yet.
Right.
And maybe that's what's keeping things alive. Or our Russian colleagues they got access to a really high sensitivity infrared camera. And in one case, we saw the liver really active, right? And so it was like, is there glycogenesis happening? Is there some way that there's a sustaining of the body?
Right.
And from the Tibet medical perspective, this energy, this subtle wind at the heart is incredibly energetically strong. Even though it's subtle, it's very powerful for the body to be sustained in that way. It's considered the way that radiance or the way that the kind of luminosity of the body is maintained. So if someone's really beautiful, like, you have such a beautiful complexion, we'd say, that's the dung, that's the radiance. They have access to that subtle energy also in the living state.
Yeah. And we know that, too, in the West. We just maybe don't have that same construct, but we say, like, people are glowing or,
yes.
we recognize that. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is also fascinating. So are there any at this point, take homes or I know you said that, there's no measurable brain activity, which is not surprising. And you mentioned this one example of some liver activities still going on. Is there anything consistent yet that's been seen across these cases?
Consistency on the forensic side is what we're calling this plateau, so that there's attenuated decomposition, so relatively minimal decomposition until the state is released, and then it's super fast, actually.
Okay.
It's been pretty startling.
faster than normal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
Or normal, but like 3 weeks late.
Yes.
In a right. way. And then quite rapid compared to what it had been
right.
before. The area around the chest is also differentially less decomposition, which is also interesting from the Tibetan side as well, that that's considered where the subtle mind and subtle wind is still present. I think what's really interesting is that we don't have really a great understanding of what we're looking for, I think, from the Western side that would show consciousness.
Right.
So if we can say, yes, attenuated decomposition, something's keeping it, maybe the bacteria are responding a certain way, what does that tell us about consciousness? We don't know. So this is what Tipton Jimbala had asked. He said, do you think we'll ever kind of intersect from these two traditions of what we're trying to answer as a project? And I don't know. But I think where the project now is going is to look at developing a longitudinal healthy aging study that's really looking at over the life course, you know, who are these practitioners? What is their life history in a way? And then can we really look at their brains over time? And is there a way that we can predict who's going to go into Tukdom or not? Mm. And if we have good relationships with these practitioners, will there be an opportunity to observe them during the dying state? And what's been really interesting is some of our colleagues in places around the U.S. and Canada in ICUs, Juma Borjigin, she's in University of Michigan, has looked at really interesting EEG signatures as people are dying, kind of these flashes in the parietal lobe and, you know, massive gamma surges. And so she has also referenced the Tukdom study of that there's so much we don't know about this. And people's experiences and people who come out of comas and kind of what is the signature that allows them to, yeah, reawaken versus not, and what are we seeing in the brain? And so I think we might have an opportunity to look at that if we develop these relationships with these practitioners as well.
Yeah, this is so fascinating at, you know, the edge of what we understand about life, you know, and what is life, what is consciousness? When does it end or transition? And these are huge, you know, philosophical questions that, as you said, you know, Western science doesn't really have a good way of measuring consciousness, like at a physiological level.
Yep.
That's always been this big disconnect in that field. So that's just, this is really amazing that you're engaged in this project. And I assume it will be a long-term project or...
Yeah, I mean, Geshe Lodesambu, Geshe Ngawa Norbu, who are... our associate directors of the project and who were Emory Tibet Science Initiative first batch leading in Sarah Jay and also Ganon Jangse and Bilokupi Mungod, they talk about, for them, this is a 7-generation project, and that's what His Holiness has said. So they see also their role as kind of training the next generation of monastics in their institutions and seeing this as... maybe science will develop new ways of knowing. Maybe there will be interesting things that come from the practitioner side. But I think what's exciting also for me to see is that, you know, some people assume that there's things that are really for Western science to understand about this project. But what I've observed also in the project is that it's really inspired the new generation of Tibetan youth to take stock in their own culture and to realize, oh my gosh, these are the great masters, right? The old practitioners who maybe in Tibet had done 3 3-year retreats in their lifetime and have come into India and are teachers, right?
Yeah.
And I think it helps them to have an appreciation of their own tradition and also question what they want to do with their lives and kind of coming back to that place of maybe we want to focus on practice. So Geshe Ngawa said that in his science class, all the science students are now waking up super early at 3 or 4 a.m. And these are like young monks, right, that are now meditating and trying to, like, you know, build the skills especially in the Gaelic institutions, right? A lot of it's focused on scholasticism, especially for the first many years. So that's been really exciting.
Thank you. circle back. You had kind of touched on the microbiome and the importance of that in all of these processes. And of course, we're learning so much scientifically about the importance of the microbiome and pretty much any process we look at. And I know that that's also a piece of a study that you've been doing through Mind and Life, a funded project, looking at individual differences in terms of contemplative practice and response, and then weaving the microbiome in there. Could you share about that?
Absolutely. A lot of that project was inspired by some of, I think, what we've seen more systemically about adverse experiences in meditation and Willoughby Britton's work. And now I think is being tracked much more in the contemplative science field of as mindfulness becomes more popular, as the McMindfulness phenomena, right? That people might not have access to teachers to help them to work through meditation experiences and what's considered a positive experience or what might be challenging, but just part of the experience. And so the inspiration for that was to look at, we have these massive meditation interventions that our center runs, both in person with MBSR, but now through the app. And how can we help people understand more about their own vulnerabilities and maybe when it might worsen a situation, so depression, bipolar, right? And so Tibetan medical theory has such a rich background with Buddhism that it's a medical tradition that's evolved, you know, over thousands of years to understand what could happen in terms of health implications. And so we thought that, okay, well, constitutional theory, these certain kinds of affective habits of the mind mean also that certain kind of practices are more beneficial or more needed by certain individuals than others. And some might have a proclivity to having adverse experiences with other kinds of practices. So this project is looking at retrospectively three different meditation interventions, this huge MBSR study that we had funded by the NIH, and then these more app-based interventions to recontact all those participants and to say, you know, we'd like you to poop in a bag for us, give us a gut microbiome sample, and to take this survey to self-assess their constitution. And this has been developed with Menzikang, the Tibet Medical Institute, of helping people to have a constitutional self-assessment, then having them report back on their dietary, their lifestyle habits, so that we can kind of also infer how much they know their own constitution versus how much it might actually be. And then a stressful life events rating scale to see how much also their previous experiences might have actually implicated certain kinds of responses to emotions or how they experience, how they report their constitution as well. And so we've taken all this data and we're looking at then, can we predict who did well in these different interventions? So it's assuming that there is a profile that stays static throughout the life course, like a constitution. And so this is something that a lot of the microbiome research has been looking at. There's certain aspects that if someone didn't have a massive change in their diet or a massive change in terms of medical conditions of huge antibiotics, that they will have a profile that stays relatively consistent throughout their life course with some changes. And then there's other aspects that change. So our Simon Goldberg is looking at the other aspects. So how much does the microbiome change from an intervention? And so we're kind of intersecting at different aspects of this question to say what is static and what is changeable? And can we predict then how people do with mindfulness, social connectivity, or loving kindness meditation, and then insight meditations to see who would, from a specific constitutional type, benefit more and who needs to be a little bit more aware of their vulnerabilities as well.
And what are you using to determine, you know, how well someone is doing with these practices? Is it the number of kind of adverse experiences, or is there some other metrics of kind of well-being shifts or...
Yeah, so these are all the rating scales of the mindfulness rating scale. We have Dweck scale. We're looking at aspects of de-reification. So it's reported within each of the meditation studies. So on each of their scales, how they are showing performance by the individual participant. And so we're just taking their outcomes that they've already assessed from the study, each of their different scales, and then linking that to the different constitutions.
Cool. Could you just describe de-reification?
Absolutely. So the degree to which we assume our reality and our experience of reality is is real. And so often the way that we interpret certain kinds of experiences are as if they are actually happening in our life. But often it's our own interpretations of those experiences. So it helps people to just have some distance to start reinterpreting experience in terms of our assumptions of our reality and our experience with it.
So like meaning mostly you're spinning a thought in your mind, but you're kind of responding as if that's definitely real.
Projecting that out into the world. Yep. Yeah. So the ability for a person to kind of take some distance and to understand that process of how we co-create our realities.
Great. Well, I know you've also been engaged coming back to kind of the Tibetan medical system and herbal treatments and different kinds of treatments that are used in that system in relation to COVID and the pandemic and how certain populations responded to that. So can you share a little bit about that study?
Absolutely. Thank you. I think when COVID started breaking out in Wuhan, there was a lot of concern on how fast it was going to transmit across into the Tibetan Plateau. Across China. This is before it really hit globally. And so I think our Tibetan communities in Tibet were really starting to take stock of their own resources. And SARS, I think, was a dress rehearsal for that. Mm-hmm. And so in the Tibet medical tradition, there's an understanding that we are experiencing a degenerate age, that we should expect more and more virulent infectious disease, more and more epidemics, bodies that are not as strong and are more susceptible, that we have created imbalances in our environment and co-created the conditions for challenge in this world, and that there are more aspects of greed and disconnection with the environment. And so this was expected kind of from the Tibetan medical community. And so there's specific formulas that have been online that they've been ready to kind of bring out for this time period.
Uh-huh.
And different ways of, I mean, things like quarantining, all these things are in like 7th, 8th century texts, right?
Hmm.
This has been a long awaited period, I guess you could say. And so watching how COVID spread, the Tibetan Plateau was not heavily hit. But Chinese policy was that anybody who was infected should be hospitalized, go through antivirals, and go through massive steroid treatments. So we didn't actually have an opportunity to see how did Tibetan medicine do on its own. And there was real interest from the Tibet medical community in Tibet to see that, because I think they've been ready for this and also not trusting totally what antivirals might do or even steroid treatment. So as the pandemic unfolded, a lot of our Tibetan communities in North America were some of the heaviest hit. I mean, Jackson Heights was probably was ground zero for when COVID first hit the U.S. And this was a very hard time for so many communities. And I think what was interesting for me to witness is a real shock by the community side that they would go to the hospital and be turned away. Right. There was an assumption that, oh, Western medicine knows how to deal with this. This is a massive global health crisis. And, you know, the answer that they got in many of the Tibetan community are nurses in ICU wards and are healthcare workers. Right. And so they were also surprised on the internal system side that there wasn't much to do. And they were turning people away and telling people to just go home, you know, eat healthy. And so Tibetan medicine in the Tibetan community in exile particularly has primarily been used for chronic conditions,
okay.
I think, because, or it's become known for chronic conditions. So there wasn't as much of a, that's not where people would go primarily if they had a cold. They would use specific formulas sometimes. But so this was something that the community itself started contacting a lot of Tibetan doctors. And we said, wow, we have an opportunity to just observe these cases. So we contacted all of our Tibetan doctors across North America and said, please just, you know, they all have agreements in their own clinics for research that they say to their patients, you know, can I use your data for research? So on a clinic by clinic basis, they can have de-identified data where they take all identifiers out. And so we said, if you just send it to us, then we can analyze that data. So we started getting different funding from the International Association for the Study of Traditional Asian Medicine, IASTM, which is a very big supporter of Asian medical systems, the Global Health Research Fund at Stanford, Arizona Friends of Tibet, Culture, Mind, and Brain Network, just supporting this idea that this is a community that is marginalized, that doesn't necessarily get identified epidemiologically often, that they're not necessarily counted. They get, they're part of an invisibility often because there's no tracking of their data, right? Mm. If they get turned away from being tested, right, they never are tested. They're never a data point in any system. And so they kind of fall through the cracks. And so we kind of pieced together small donations and put this study together, got IRB approval at Dartmouth and University of Minnesota and here at UW. And it was kind of a, shall we say, Sandlot Kids version of research that we just were able to bring together all of these physicians seeing a lot of patients. I mean, Andre Kinev-Gyamso, he wasn't able to send a lot of his patient data from Toronto, but in the first several months, he saw over 300 patients. I mean, wow. It was like a massive amount.
How many Tibetan medical practitioners or clinics are there in kind of North America or wherever you were studying this from?
Yeah, so there were 20 that we contacted, so there's not a lot.
Yeah.
There's more than that practicing, but 20 is probably the ones that consistently, for their main jobs, see patients. Many other physicians, like many refugee communities who have medical training, are doing other jobs, driving Uber,
right,
washing dishes, right?
Also a medical doctor.
And then seeing patients on the side, right?
Yeah.
So this is the reality of the Tibetan exile and Himalayan exile community, too. But there was 20 physicians in Canada and the U.S., and then 15 of those felt like they could basically handle the extra load of also sending their cases and participating. And we put them through, you know, different research trainings in Tibetan. We had a research assistants who are young Tibetans, savvy, you know, with the research methods, who are training to go into medical school on their own, or ones at UC Davis studying neurobiology, Jatin Chungne under Cliff Saran. And so they were kind of like tutoring their elders on how to do research, which was super beautiful, super amazing to see those interactions. And some also Westerners, one, Kristen Blake, was an acupuncturist going back to medical school. She was just really interested in Tibet medicine and wanted to support also the research. Another one, Natalie Skopikia Emery, was wanting to learn more. And so it was just this beautiful community effort of everyone learning together, bringing our resources together at a time that was so difficult, to be able to show that Tibetan medicine, those who went under a Tibetan medicine regimen compared to those who went home and just went under self-care and public health guidelines, almost halved the time to recovery in terms of symptom recovery. So the outpatient studies that were done at that initial stage of the Wuhan strain found that it was about 16 to 21 days of recovery. And in the Tibet medical regimen, we were able to find about an average of 11.7 days, which is a big deal at that time.
And so this regimen would have included, like you were saying earlier, diet and lifestyle approaches, and then also pharmacological, like herbal treatments as well? Or
absolutely. Yeah. So what they should be eating, what they should not be eating, mindsets, also how to maintain connectivity when they might not be physically able to connect with family or friends, but how to kind of keep the mind light. Because I think fear, panic was a huge aspect at that time too. How to maintain certain kind of daily rhythms and routines. But the primary intervention, so to speak, were these formulas of 3 to 35, 40 different ingredients of botanicals and geologics, of where they would boil them as different decoctions and eat them as pills. And so it was often 3 to 5 different formulas a day for the period.
That's so interesting. I'm thinking in a couple different directions. One is kind of from an anthropological lens, people being able to connect to a medical system within their own community and having that kind of support, social support, cultural support. That also feels like a big piece that, you know, you can't, obviously you can't piece that out from the pharmacology or, you know, the other interventions that they were receiving. And then also just wondering kind of the bigger picture of Western understandings of Tibetan medicine. Has there been much research from a Western perspective on, for example, these herbs or the different views of constitutions or the ways that Tibetan medicine is practiced?
Yeah. So in our article, we review just briefly all the different pharmacological evidence that's related to these pathways, especially central nervous system inflammation mm-hmm. and lung function, just inflammatory pathways. So there's been some really amazing work now. And it's probably 10 years ago, I would have said there's nothing. uh-huh. And it's just over these last 10 years that it has just surged. And what's exciting is that a lot of our Tibetan colleagues in Tibet have partnered with a lot of Chinese pharmacologists who are actually really supportive of really interesting network pharmacology, systems biology, looking at these, what we call pleiotropic signatures in the body, which means that a single formula might act on different pathways in the body differently for different individuals. And so we can't necessarily say that one formula acts the exact same way in each person and for each condition. And so they've done some beautiful work looking at how a single formula will act differently on different receptors and what's in those formulas that we can't, you know, at Emory, we had this wonderful collaboration with Raymond Shinazi, pharmacologist known as the king of pills, right? And so he has produced so many remarkable medicines, antivirals as well. But the method has been to separate all the constituent parts to look at what's active and what's toxic, right? Mm-hmm. And in Tibet medicine, you can't do that because it works together as a synergy. And so now we have the opportunity to be looking at what does that synergy look like when it has 10,000 different compounds and it needs to work as a whole. Mm-hmm. And we've learned from especially from AIDS research and these, you know, these cocktails, HIV cocktails, that you want to make sure that the body is not selecting for resistance and you want to be able to be flexible and move with agility through the body's mechanisms for creating that resistance. And this is what that does. So we were able to show some of that pharmacological research that's been done previously, although we weren't testing it for our study. And then we were able to also show that a lot of the meditation research also supports this, that these do have real effects on the immune system. And that's why we published in the Brain Behavior Immunity Integrative Journal as a psychoneuroimmunology journal, because they're used to those conversations to say, we don't know which part is working, but there's a lot of parts working here together. And how do we take that apart?
Yeah.
But I think what was really sweet for me is that Susan Bauer Wu, president of Mind and Life previously, she was the one at Emory that really brought together a lot of the Tibetan physicians way back in 2012, 2013 to look at cancer and to say, why don't we look at what you've achieved in terms of your clinical work and see which cases or which types of cancer are difficult to treat in Western medicine and what's achieved complete remission. So in 2014, this is the paper that we published, which was three different kinds of cancer that are very difficult to treat by Western medical standards, gastric adenocarcinoma, so of the gut, and then red cell aplasia and chronic myeloid leukemia, so two blood cancers. And to say that still, after fully just taking Tibet medicine 7 years out, they remained in remission. And so part of why I felt like this COVID project was just so amazing is that Tibetan physicians haven't historically kept patient data, right? It's like right. The patients come, they see them, they keep their little booklet and they go. So to help them to learn how to maintain data, to keep case records, I mean, that's part of the project too. So the fact that these physicians in their private clinics all over the country, just doing their thing, seeing patients, could come together and produce this really wonderful result. So I think this was the unspoken massive success as they realized that they have so much strength as a community to show resilience, to show what they are doing every day. So.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. I can really see how you bring that anthropological perspective and that cultural perspective into all of these different projects and merging it with the biology. I think it's really beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah. And Sienna Craig, who was one of my committee members, one of my mentors also, it was so sweet to see her work in the community in Jackson Heights in New York, taking basically COVID diaries of all the Himalayan communities and just having them throughout the COVID, especially the initial part of the pandemic, just doing verbal records of their experiences and to see how that intersected also with our project to see what was making a difference in terms of that community cohesion, access to their culture, access to teachings online, right, to give them hope, to give them perspective. And so that was also, yeah, such a beautiful part.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if as we're coming to a close, just kind of stepping back from your fascinating and broad body of work, just any reflections on how being embedded in this system of Tibetan medicine and in these communities with these perspectives on the body and on health. And you said even, you know, from your childhood, you bring this from a Native perspective, an Indigenous perspective in America. How this has shaped you and maybe any lessons for Western culture that we can derive from this?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I've seen my role really as cultural translator, as being a bridge between worlds, a bridge between ways of knowing. Mm. And I think that in the process has, and just working with my patients, is helping people to come back home to their bodies and to their communities, to their environments, and knowing what that is and having time to reconnect to those things and people and places that make us whole. And that this is a medical system that's incredibly complex, and yet it's really simple. It's about just these processes that we all know and appreciate and understand and have an intuitive sense of that. But I think in our world, we've gotten too busy, we've gotten disconnected from those, and just bringing that synergy back together and giving people permission to do that has been a big part of the journey.
Wonderful. Well, Tani, thank you so much for all of your work and for taking the time today to share this with us. It's been a real joy to chat.
Thank you so much, Wendy. It's such a pleasure to be here, and thank you so much for having me here.
This episode was edited and produced by me and Phil Walker. And music on the show is from Blue Dot Sessions and Universal. Show notes and resources for this and other episodes can be found at podcast.mindandlife.org. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and share it with a friend. And if something in this conversation sparked insight for you, let us know. You can send an email or voice memo to podcast@mindandlife.org. Mind and Life is a production of the Mind and Life Institute. Visit us at mindandlife.org, where you can learn more about how we bridge science and contemplative wisdom to foster insight and inspire action towards flourishing. If you value these conversations, please consider supporting the show. You can make a donation at mindandlife.org under support. Any amount is so appreciated, and it really helps us create this show. Thank you for listening.